sense. Don't worry about it if it does. You can pick it up if you didn't see it. I know you're a doctor. You get
told. Okay.
Right?
It's okay.
Okay. Start it. Okay. So welcome, everybody, to, I think, the 14th Yahrzeit Shir in memory of my father. The Rambam, at the beginning of the second parak of Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah, speaks about how one reaches a level of Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem, love and fear of God. So Rambam says, V'heichi aderech le'avaso v'yiraso, how do you reach that level of loving and fearing God? V'shashi yisbonein ha'odem v'masav v'ruav ha'nifloim ha'gedoylim, when you appreciate the tremendous wonders of the world, and you see the tremendous wisdom that went into it from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that it has no limit. So then you're filled. You should be consumed with love and awe of the tremendous majesty of Hashem, and you should feel a tremendous desire that you want to come closer to Hashem. You want to understand more about the universe. So we believe that one important avenue of Yiras Hashem, of having a fear and awe of heaven, is through an appreciation for science, for an appreciation for the wonders that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has placed in the world. So I wanted to discuss this year the ABCs of DNA and Halacha, because DNA is really a wonder that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has placed in the world, that in every single cell of every organism, that there is this code, this DNA code, this deoxyribonucleic acid that is different with respect to every single human being, and it is able to identify the singularity, the individuality of every single person in a way that we did not previously even appreciate. I think that DNA was originally identified by some scientist in Switzerland, Frederick Meischer, in the 1860s. And then there were two scientists who were working at Cambridge University in the 1950s, who named James D. Watson and Francis Crick, who were able to figure out that the DNA forms two different strands that appear like a spiral staircase, like a figure eight with a little bit more to it, that consists of these patterns of what we call nucleotides that form this special coding that every single human being has, and it has to be extracted so that you would be able to see it and identify it, and scientists are able to do that. And even when you don't have a full body of a person in front of you, but you have some DNA sampling from some cells that were recovered, even from a person's toothbrush or their hairbrush, you're able to compare those with the DNA of just a part of a person's body, a fragment of skin or muscle or tissue, and extract the cells, and you're able to see the same coding. You're able to make an identification that these body parts must have come from this individual, even though you otherwise would not be able to recognize the person. It's just a tiny little piece of skin from their back or from their hand or from their foot, and you're able to make a full identification on this basis. So the question becomes, from a halakhic perspective, what do we do with this DNA? Does it mean anything in terms of our ability to identify people, in terms of our ability to be able to make appropriate determinations of halakha? So there are two avenues in halakha where we might not have an entire scene sketched out in front of us, and we might not have two witnesses who would be able to testify in a way that we would otherwise be able to make halakhic conclusions and determinations, but we rely sometimes upon other forms of evidence. One form is called umdana. Umdana means that we have tremendous circumstantial evidence. But the Gemara says that our ability to rely upon umdana is very limited. It tells the story of Gamal Ochel Ben HaGimolim. Somebody owns a wild camel, and this camel is acting up, and there are other camels next to that camel, and one of the camels is dead, was clearly beaten up or bitten by some other camel, but nobody saw what happened. So Rav Acha says, well, you can assume that the wild camel was the one that inflicted the deathly blow to the camel, which is dead. And therefore, the owner of the wild camel would be obligated to provide compensation to the owner of the dead camel. And the Chachamim disagree, and they say, we don't rely upon umdanus. No matter how strong, we don't rely upon circumstantial evidence. It's the famous story of Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach. The Gemara in Shavuos, Daf Lamed Daled, he says, Erev ben Nechama, he says that I need to be comforted that what I'm saying is 100% true, and there's nothing I can do about it. I saw a person run after another individual in some demolished building where there was nobody else around. And then I went inside and I saw that the individual who was being pursued is lying on the ground with a giant blood stain and is bleeding to death. And the person who ran after him is holding up a bloody knife and is cackling with joy. And I really was pretty sure that the pursuer was the murderer. But I turned to the murderer and I said, there's nothing that I can do. The Torah says, Al pishnai meidim o shlosha eidim yumas ameis. Torah says that you need direct eyewitness testimony of two witnesses in order to convict somebody of murder. And therefore, I'm not able to put you to death, even though I know very well that you're the murderer. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will have to take care of you, which he did. HaKadosh Baruch Hu brought about a snake, conveniently enough, that was a venomous, deadly snake, and the snake bit the murderer, and that was the end of him. But we don't have the ability to administer justice ourselves in these situations. And there's a very large amount of literature, because there do seem to be certain passages in the Gemara that indicate that we can rely upon circumstantial evidence. There's a psak of Rabbeinu Asher, the Rosh, where he writes in one place that maybe for halakhic purposes, the opinion of Rav Acha is not discounted entirely for difficult cases where the Beis Din would not otherwise be able to arrive readily at a decision. But by and large, we don't rely upon umdanus. So question about if you have a situation where a man is known to have been in a building that collapsed. We have this question now, unfortunately, with the Surfside tragedy, and you don't recover the remains. Can you rely upon the umdana, the very strong circumstantial evidence that if the man would still be alive, you would have heard from him? Because nowadays that there are so many different modes and means of communication that you can rely upon. So there would be an easy way for this missing person, man or woman, to contact their family to notify them that they're alive. And if they had no reason to run away, they were getting along with their spouse and so forth. So maybe this should be considered sufficient evidence. And the Truma Sadeshin, hundreds of years ago, Israel Isselin, came to the conclusion that this is something that can be taken into consideration. I have an aguna situation. The man is missing. And if I don't declare him as dead, then the wife will never be able to remarry. So he says that you can take that into consideration together with other probabilities that would lead in the direction of our concluding that the person had probably died. So there's a question, do we take into consideration DNA evidence as a form of circumstantial evidence that maybe can be combined with other evidence when making these types of determinations? So Rav Asher Weiss has a tshuva in Chelek Gimel of Minchas Asher, where he points out that although there are those who make the argument that DNA evidence sort of falls in the category of umdana, of circumstantial evidence and the like, but he says that he thinks there's a different category of halacha that is more appropriate for our classification of a DNA. And umdana helps us understand exactly what happened. However, when it comes to DNA, it's not that we look at the DNA in order to reconstruct a scene of that somebody borrowed money from somebody else, that Reuven killed Shimon, or some type of an actual maisa, some sort of an action that occurred, but rather DNA is more in the category of simonim, of identification signs. And we have a halakhic discussion about what are considered to be good identification signs in different areas of halakha in order to identify an object, an aveda, a lost object that it belongs to somebody. Or, for example, in this context as well, you have a man who's missing and we need to identify his remains in order to permit the wife to remarry. What's considered to be a good enough identification sign? And the Gemara has a discussion about whether simonim are de'araisa or are they de'rabonin. When we say that sometimes an aveda, a lost article, can be returned when the owner gives a simon, gives us some type of an identification mark. So is that a din d'araisa that you return it based on an identification mark, or is that a din d'rabbanan, a rabbinic law? Most of the poskim are of the opinion that it's a rabbinic law. It's not a din d'araisa. It's a rabbinic law that you rely upon identification marks in certain situations. If it's only d'rabbanan, we wouldn't be able to rely upon that to absolutely and verifiably identify a man as being dead in order to permit the wife to remarry. If you look at the person and you say, oh yeah, I remember that he had a wart in a particular location, and this body, even though I don't recognize the face anymore, many days have passed, whatever it is, but I recognize that there's a wart in that place and must be this person. So that wouldn't be good enough. But a number of the Mefarshim, including the Hagos Mordechai, including the Kesef Mishnah, including the Prima Gadim, they say that there really are three different categories of a simonim, three different categories of identification marks. There is what we call simonim gruim, low-level identification marks that don't count for anything. Like, for example, you remember the person was tall, you remember the person was short. Well, big deal. Lots of people are tall, lots of people are short. Then there are simonim beinonim, intermediate identification marks. That's more what the Gemara talks about when it comes to our simonim deraisa derabbanan, and we say that they are only derabbanan, they're only rabbinic in nature, that you can rely sometimes on identification marks. So that's talking about it. What we were discussing before. You remember a person has a wart in a particular location? Okay, so there are a number of people who might have that wart. You remember that this purse that was lost is a little bit smudged? Okay, so there are a lot of purses that are a little bit smudged. That was what we would call, but not, it's not as common as whether, let's say, the purse is white or black. That would be very low level. It's more what we call an intermediate type of identification mark. But then there's something that's known as simonim mufhakim, ironclad identification marks. Ironclad identification marks, that's something that you can rely upon absolutely. That's something where everybody would agree it works, even on a Torah level, that you can identify an object, you can identify a person on that basis. The Gemara in Gittin, on Daf Yud Ches Amud Beis, talks about, for example, that there's a get that's lying in the street. It's a very big deal. If you're going to utilize a get, the Jewish bill of divorce, to use it to divorce a particular woman, you want to make sure it's a kosher get. Otherwise, she might think she's divorced, she'll get remarried, and she'll be committing adultery. So this is a very important determination, requires an ironclad identification mark in order to deliver this get to the woman. So what's considered to be an ironclad identification mark, according to the Gemara? If somebody says there's a nekiv betzad os ploni, Mavashi says in the Gemara, if you can identify it and say, I remember there's a hole, but not only that there's a hole in the get, that wouldn't be an ironclad identification mark, because a number of gittin might have holes. But the hole is right next to the following letter and the following word on the following line. Oh, that's really, really specific. If we write a get in our Bezdin and we send it to another Bezdin for delivery and we have to identify it very specifically, we're always going to make a little hole next to one of the letters in the get, and we're going to identify that very specifically. Why is that? Because the Gemara says that the other Bezdin will have the right to rely upon that identification mark for purposes of the delivery of the get to the woman, so that she will be considered to be divorced according to Jewish law. So then the question becomes, what is the geder? What is the criterion for a simen mufa, for an ironclad identification mark? So there is a tshuva by Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi, in which he quotes the opinion of the Rabbeinu Yerucham, who says that it has to be so unique that it is an identification mark that nobody else in the world would have. Well, if we're considering a hole next to a certain letter in a get as a good identification mark, hard to say that would never ever happen to any other get throughout the entirety of the world. So Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi points out that most opinions don't really agree with this. Even that opinion of Rabbeinu Yerucham probably doesn't mean that you couldn't have it anywhere else in the world, or that a particular identification mark that a person has is not shared by anybody in the world. But it means that you just don't know of anybody else who has it. You don't think that anyone in your Medina, in your country, in your state, in the area where you live, that anybody else would have it. You would be very, very surprised, but not that nobody else in the world has it. But that the standard that is generally codified by the various poskim, by the halakhic authorities, is that of the Maaseis Binyamin. The Maaseis Binyamin was an authority who lived roughly the same time as the Ramah, the famous Ashkenazic authority in the Shulchan Aruch. He lived in the mid to late 16th century. So the Maaseis Binyamin says that in order for a simen, for an identification mark, let's say on a human body, to be considered to be a simen mufak, to be considered to be an ironclad identification sign, it has to be something that would be shared by less than 1 in 1,000 people or less than 1 in 2,000 people. Which one is it? Less than 1 in 1,000 or less than 1 in 2,000? I don't know. I guess you could take the 1 in 1,000 measure. That's what's generally quoted. But some say, like my Rebbe of Herschel Schefter Shlita, that the measure you'll use may depend on how many people you are identifying at a time. If you have, like you did in the time of the World Trade Center tragedy, two towers that collapsed upon 2,800 people or more at that time, so then he said that you would want an identification mark if you were identifying one of the victims to be less than 1 in 2,900 people, however many people happen to be there. And that probably could be an explanation of what the Maaseis Binyamin is talking about. It depends on how many people need to be found. But even in a situation where one person is missing, you're looking for an identification mark. Certainly, it should be one that has a probability of error of less than 1 in 1,000 in terms of the number of people who share it. So the poskim say, for example, if you're able to find the skull, you can't otherwise identify the person. Maybe the face and body have decomposed somewhat, but you're able to take out the teeth and you're able to compare those teeth with other dental records that we have of the person. So that's something which is very unique. The same dental records are not shared by 1 in 1,000 people, much less than that. And so too, with respect to fingerprint evidence, if you have a set of fingerprints, you compare it to the fingerprints of the individual who is missing and there's a match. So that would also be considered a simen mufak. For these purposes, there actually was a case, believe it or not, we dealt with a number of the Aguna cases in the aftermath of the World Trade Center tragedy. We had a case where they found enough of the body where they actually were able to take fingerprints, a fingerprint sample, and compare it to that of the missing person and make the identification on that basis. So this is something that comes up. But where does the DNA fall in with respect to this picture? When it comes to DNA, DNA identification is not something that you physically look at. It's part of some type of a biological process where you have a laboratory determination of a genetic material that is encoded in the person's cells. To what degree does halacha view this as a dispositive? To what degree does halacha view this as significant? And some of the poskim discuss that there was a big debate a number of years ago when it came to, for example, doing a blood test to make determinations of a paternity. For example, when they could not determine who was really the father of a child and who should have to pay child support, for example, to the child. And there would be blood tests that would indicate, based on whether the father was a type A and the mother was a type B, or the mother was a type O. So there are different permutations of what the child can be and what could possibly be produced. And if you know the blood type of the mother and you know the blood type of the father, sometimes it just doesn't match the end product in terms of the actual child. And then you know that the father can't be the father of this child. This was a concern because whenever that type of a determination would be made, so then it would also raise the question, let's say the father was a type A and the mother's a type A and the child's a type AB, that can't be. Child can't be a type AB under those circumstances. So it would raise questions as to whether that would mean that we have to treat the child as a mamzer. Do we have to treat the child now as illegitimate? Never mind that the father might be exempted from having to pay child support because you've proven that it's not really his child, but maybe now the child will have to be viewed as illegitimate. So there was a lot of concern and consternation about this. Many, many rabbinic authorities, especially here in Israel, came to the conclusion that you could not, for halakhic purposes, rely upon these blood tests. They pointed to a Gemara in Nida and Daf Lamed Aleph, where the Gemara says that there are three partners with respect to every child who is born, the father, the mother, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And there are different parts of the child that are contributed by either parent. The father contributes the bones and the mother contributes the red. Whatever is red is contributed by the mother, whatever is white is contributed by the father. And the Vilna Gaon says included in the materials or the substance of the child that is red that only comes from the mother is the blood. So therefore they said, how can you determine based on a blood test the paternity of the child when the blood comes only from the mother and not from the father? And they felt very strongly about this. The Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg, had another argument. He said, science comes and science goes, and the science of today is not the science of 100 years ago, and the science of 100 years ago is not the science of 200 years ago. It's certainly not the science of 2,000 years ago. And therefore, right now, they happen to think that these tests are dispositive, that they are compelling, but maybe 100 years from now, they'll change their minds and it won't be. And therefore, we have to kind of wait around and see, and we can't make such hasty determinations on this basis. Now, the former Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Israel, Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog, was not happy about this. He wrote an article in the medical halakha journal Asya, in which he accused the various rabbis who were not prepared to rely upon blood test types of determinations to the proverbial animal that places its head in the sand. I think that would be the ostrich. He says that it is sort of an insult to the beauty and the grandeur and the splendor of our Torah if we blind ourselves to the wisdom of the world that is around us, that part of what should be our source of pride is that we are well-versed not only in the minutiae of a Torah, but also in the incorporation of all of these scientific principles into our Torah discussions. And therefore, he felt that these types of blood tests should be taken more seriously from the standpoint of halacha. It doesn't mean, though, in defense of the Rabbanim, and there were many, including Rabbi Avadya Yosef as well, who is very strong about this, and Rosh Hashanah Mashash, who is very strong about this as well, that it doesn't mean that they were being oblivious to science. What they were doing was reconciling the realities of science to the demands of halacha, and they were saying that based upon this Talmudic passage, maybe that's telling us that whatever the reason, when it comes to halakhic determinations, we're not supposed to reckon with these types of blood tests. Not that we're rejecting the science entirely, but that it's not relevant for this sphere of halakha. Now, the language of some of the tshuvos is that we know better than science, but I think that probably what they were saying is that for halakhic determinations, we know better than science how to apply these different principles for purposes of halakha. Because there are different mechanisms that we use in different spheres of halakha. And to say that it's not appropriate for a paternity test does not mean that it's not appropriate for anything else as either. Like, for example, there was a case in the Mohammed HaShechror where there were a number of chayalim, a number of soldiers who were killed in a terrorist attack. And unfortunately, based on the circumstances, when the bodies were recovered, they really could not be identified. And Rav Aryeh Levin, the famous tzaddik in our time, at that point did a goral hagra. He did the famous lottery of the Vilna Gaon of going through the different pages of Tanakh and putting one's finger in different places. The Goral HaGra is a complicated sort of Kabbalistic exercise in order to identify which body was which soldier so that there would be the appropriate grave marker, the appropriate matseva placed next to the burial of that soldier. So as a number of poskim have pointed out, we don't use Goral HaGra to determine paternity of financial obligations or to free a woman to remarry, for example. But for purposes of just being able to bury bodies and put markers and matzevos, so then the Goral HaGra could be appropriate. Different types of exercises are appropriate in different types of circumstances. But how does this carry over to DNA? A couple of the postgame, if you look at the Tshuva by Rav Mashash and the Shemesh Umagein, Chela Gimel, Simen Nun Beis. You look in Rav Avadya Yosef's Tshuvas, Yabia Omer, Chela Yud, Simen Yud Gimel. They seem to address situations where it was not a question of simply disproving the paternity of a father, which is what these old-time blood tests would do, but affirmatively proving who the father would be in terms of imposing a financial obligation or creating a mamzeris question, for example. And even though the tshuvas don't use the words DNA, it seems like they probably are discussing DNA because the other blood tests can't tell you definitively, based on blood type, exactly which individual is the father. And they say not to rely upon it in terms of the determination of financial support or of mamzeris, or for establishing a custody. In those circumstances, DNA would not be considered to be an effective type of indication, just like the old-time blood tests were not either. However, one can argue that if your main source is the Gemara in Nida, and others reinterpret the Gemara in Nida, by the way, and they say, including Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, he said that it doesn't necessarily mean that only the mother contributes to the blood. It could be the mother is the main catalyst of the blood, but maybe blood type, for example, could also come from the father. Maybe there are different ways of defining, you know, the father's contribution of the blood type so that it doesn't run afoul of the simple reading of the Gemara. Maybe there's a different Talmudic passage that seems to slightly contradict this Gemara. That it's not necessarily so crystal clear that you couldn't rely on a blood test based on this Gemara. Not everyone necessarily has to agree with the Vilna Gaon that the Gemara was also addressing blood altogether. So there are a number of questions in that regard. But you can say with DNA, DNA is not blood-based. DNA is cell-based. You take it from the bones, you take it from the nails, you take it from different parts of an individual's body, and there is this DNA coding of the different base pairings of the nucleotides. Four different bases that appear in different sequences of base pairings throughout these long strands of the DNA that are located in the nucleus of every single cell. So this is not necessarily something that comes from the blood. So Rav Avraham, who is the author of the Nishmas Avraham, discussed these issues quite a bit with Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. And Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said to him that ima bedika hazos meforsim mekubal ala olam ayideh habenis yainos berurim, that if the investigation and examination of DNA is verified through many different tests that are conducted throughout the scientific community, lidover emes, and it is accepted as something which is reliable, mistabe shigamitzat halacha efshalismo chazeh. He said, We don't believe in contradictions between science and the Torah. If there is a clear scientific method of identifying an individual, if it's really something that is proven scientifically over time, so he felt that it's something that could be relied upon. And this came up really quite a bit in the aftermath of the World Trade Center tragedy, because there were fragments of bone and skin that were discovered of missing individuals that were linked with their DNA. And the margin of error, according to the scientific experts, was not only less than 1 in 1,000, it was less than 1 in 1 billion, less than 1 in 1 trillion, or less than 1 in 1 quadrillion. I remember I would get back the results because we were in regular touch with the New York City Medical Examiner's Office. Whenever they made an identification, they would send it to us and they would give us the measure of probability. I remember one case where the coding was so unusual that they felt that it would be shared by less than 1 in 1 quintillion individuals, that it was such a remote margin of error. So if you could rely on a margin of error of less than 1 in 1,000, certainly it would seem that you could rely upon this too. So it's interesting because in the Sefer Nishmas Avraham, he cites a conversation that he had with Rav Eliashiv in Tafshin Samech Hei. Tafshin Samech Hei is 16 years ago. So that is after the World Trade Center tragedy, when a lot of this thought process was taking place amongst the poskim. And Rav Eliashiv said at that point in time that he actually thought that it is no worse than relying upon dental records or relying upon fingerprint identification. And if those are considered to be a siman mufak, an ironclad form of identification, you would say the same thing with respect to a DNA. But there was a very interesting question that was posed to Rav Eliashiv, and I have to tell you, I received a similar question myself at one point in time, and I answered exactly in the same fashion, Baruch Shekivanti. I gave an answer along the lines of what I subsequently discovered in Kobetz Halachos of Rav, Kobetz Tshuvos, excuse me, of Rav Eliashiv. But it could be, because I know that I sometimes do this, and I guess lots of people sometimes do this. You read lots of Svarim, and you don't necessarily remember where you've seen everything, so maybe it was in my head, maybe I had already seen it, and I forgot that I saw it, and then I saw it again afterwards, so perhaps I was influenced by having seen the tshuva. But in any event, Rav Eliashiv was asked the following question. There was a man who had a child, had a daughter, and his wife said, oh, by the way, this daughter is not from you. It's from some other man I had a relationship with. I don't think they remained married. But then afterwards, the man wanted to, it bothered him that his wife had said this. Now, we have a halakhic principle that even if a woman is, unfortunately, rahman al-itzlan, unfaithful to her husband, we assume that if she has a child, even if she was with her paramour, much more than she was with her husband, we assume, ro bilos hochin achara bal, that it can be presumed that the child came from the husband and didn't come from the paramour, so that the child, as long as she was still, you know, living with her husband, the child would be assumed to be that of the husband and not of her lover. So now the question is, in this case, the father, just he was bothered by not knowing for sure whether his wife was telling the truth or not. He wanted to do a DNA test. So he wrote to Rav Eliashiv, should I do a DNA test on the child? So Rav Eliashiv pointed out that there is a Gemara that seems to be a good source for the answer to this question. What's the Gemara? The Gemara tells the story of Rabbi Bana. Rabbi Bana was asked to adjudicate a case where there was a woman who said to her daughter, when she thought her husband wasn't listening, oh, I have 10 sons from your father, and only one of them is his. The husband heard this, and on his deathbed, he said, I want all of my money to go to my one son. I want it to go to my one son. Whoever is the real son, that's who I want to get my money, because he knew that only one of the sons was really his son. So they asked Rabbi Bana, because he was a very wise man, they asked him, what should we do? Rabbi Bana said, no problem. Just have all the sons go to the grave. They should take sticks and they should knock on the grave. And whichever son the grave kind of like gives a response to, so that will be the child who must have been the real child of the father. So 9 out of the 10 sons go and they knock on the grave. They come back and say, nothing really happened. What should we do? Rabbi Bana said, the child who didn't go, that's the real son. So the Rashbam says, why was this the real son? Because he had the best midos. He had the best character to know not to knock on his father's grave. That's not a nice thing to do to one's father. So therefore, he should have been the father. But says the Rashbam, it's really what we call a shuda d'daini. It's not a real determination. We don't know for sure. But Mistami said the son who was the nicest and who cared about him the most, that's the one he would have wanted to give the money to. So the Rashash in the back of the Gemara in Baba Basra asked the following question. He said there's a story in the Sefer HaChassidim. It's a story in the Sefer HaChassidim. It tells a story that there was a man who was with his with a slave and with his wife, and he gave birth to the man was on a trip, and he was a very, very wealthy man, and the wife gave birth to a child. But in the meantime, the father died. I don't have the source in front of me, but I think the mother must have died too. And then the question was, maybe he was there on a trip together with his little baby and the Eved. Yosef Chaim, if you have in front of you, I think I have a source sheet that I just don't have in front of me right now. I could look at the story. So over time, the little baby didn't know what was happening. So the Eved, the slave, took the prerogative. It's over here. I'm sorry. The slave took the prerogative of saying, "I am really the child of this man who died," and he took all of the assets. This is the story. I don't know where this is what happened. The man went on a trip with his slave, and he had lots of money, and his wife was pregnant, and the man died. Doesn't say what happened to the wife, okay? But I guess the wife wasn't in the picture somehow. And the Eved, the slave, went, and he took all of the money. He took all of the money. And now the boy grows up, and he found out that this slave claimed to have really been his son, to have really taken all of the money. And now the son is wondering, what can I do in order to prove that I'm the real son? And this other fellow is just the slave, and he's not entitled to any of the money. And nobody would listen to him, because the slave had grown up and had become, he was already an adult. He had already established himself with a good reputation, and married into distinguished families. So this child didn't really have much of a leg to stand upon in order to prove that he was really the child of this wealthy man who had died. So he came to Rav Sadia Gaon's house and asked, what should I do? And Rav Sadia Gaon said, you know what, speak to the melech, speak to the king, and the king of this entire kingdom, as to, you know, what could possibly be done. Rav Sadia Gaon must have known that he had a little bit of influence with the king. So the king then went to Rav Sadia and he said, I want you to adjudicate this case. So Rav Sadia did the following test. He took a bone that belonged to the deceased father, and he mixed the blood of some of the blood that was taken from the slave together with the bone, and some of the blood from the son together with the bone. The blood of the slave did not get absorbed into the bone, but the blood of the son got absorbed into the bone. So therefore, Rav Sadia Gaon said that clearly the son is the rightful son. And the Eved is only a slave, so all the money was taken away from the slave and was given over to the Adon, was given over to the son of the original wealthy man, and the case was resolved. So the Rashash brings a kasha from the Eliyahu Rabba. The Eliyahu Rabba says, why didn't Rabbi Bana perform this test? Why didn't Rabbi Bana perform this test to simply take a bone from the father and mix it together with the blood, a little bit of a blood sample of each one of the sons, and see which blood sample would get absorbed into the bone, because apparently this is a surefire halakhic way of establishing paternity. So some say that, well, maybe for whatever reason, they had a bone available from the father in the story of Rav Sadia Gaon, but normally you're not allowed to open up a grave in order to take out a bone of an individual who has already been buried, because that would be nivul ames, would be desecration of the dead. And we don't, the Gemara in Baba Basra, Daf Kuf Nun Dalet, indicates we don't desecrate a grave in order to adjudicate a monetary question. So maybe that's one possible answer, that in that case, for whatever reason, they had a bone to pick But in this case, they didn't have a bone. So therefore, maybe that's the difference in the two cases. But, says the Rashash, a different possible answer. And he says like this. He says, maybe the answer is that's why this was done as a shuda d'daini. It wasn't done as an absolute clarification that the son who was in the Rabbi Banaz case, the son who didn't go to the grave, that it was an absolute proof that he was the real son, because if it would have proved that he was the real son, that would have rendered the other nine sons illegitimate. And he didn't want to have a test that would cast questions on the legitimacy of the other sons. And that's why Rabbi Banaz did not do the test of Rav Sadia Gaon that's brought in the Sefer Chassidim, because that would have been absolutely definitive in terms of demonstrating that the other sons were mamzerim. So said Rav El Yoshev to the father who posed the question to him, don't do the test! Don't do the test! You have the right, as a matter of halacha, to follow the principle of ro bilos hokin achar abal, that even if a woman has an affair, we presume that the child belongs to her husband whom she lives with. And therefore, even if objectively maybe that can be proven not to be the case, we don't try to prove anything over here. We have a halachic principle to rely upon. We're not going to disturb that halachic principle. But if it would be for purposes of identifying a body so that a woman could remarry, so then that would be perfectly okay. Now, some say you don't really have to worry about the mamzeris issue. There are different approaches as to why you shouldn't have to worry about the mamzeris issue. But Shmuel Vosner, when he was asked about the reliability and admissibility of DNA evidence, and this was prior to the World Trade Center attack, so when we were dealing with those questions, we were presented with the responsum that had been written by Rav Shmuel Vosner Zatzal, giving direction because they had to identify people in Israel, unfortunately, who were victims of terrorist attacks. So he was asked about DNA identification for a number of different areas of halacha. And he said that if there is DNA that comes from the missing person himself and it matches the DNA of the corpse or of the portion of the corpse that was discovered, so then he said that it's not a simen mufak. It's not an absolute ironclad identification mark. It's korov l'simen mufak. It's close. Almost. You're almost there. You're not 100% there. So he said that when it comes to identification of a woman of a man to allow the woman to remarry, so he said then you can rely upon this type of identification together with other circumstantial evidence, like the Truma Sedeshin said, you could take that into consideration when it comes to freeing a woman, Mishuma Guna, Kilu Barabanan, so we can rely upon that combination of considerations. But when it comes to the establishment of a person as being a mamzer, then we need ironclad evidence, 100%. It has to be an absolute simen mufak. So therefore, it doesn't work in terms of establishing mamzeris. Now, others gave different answers. Like, for example, Rav Mordechai Willig, Shlita, said that it doesn't necessarily prove if the DNA matches another individual. First of all, if the individual that the DNA would match, let's say, would be if you had a situation of mamzeris, it wasn't the father, his DNA doesn't match, but we don't know whose DNA it is. So then maybe it belongs to somebody who's not even Jewish. And if a woman had an affair with a non-Jew, the child's not a mamzer, that's a technicality. Number two, it's possible, I think that's, I'm throwing that one in. Number two, it's possible that it was done through, says Rabbi Willig, artificial insemination. Maybe the child came from this other man, could be another Jewish man, and maybe we know exactly who the man is, but who said that it came from a normal intimate relationship? Maybe it came through artificial insemination. We don't know every procedure that a person does during their private time. Maybe she had artificial insemination, according to Rav Moshe Feinstein and certain other poskim. If a child is born through another man with artificial insemination, that doesn't create mamzerus. And finally, when it comes to mamzerus, we don't rely upon evidence that is not visible to the eye. Rav Asher Weiss points out, in his tshuvos and chelik gimel of the minchas asher to establish mamzerus. That's one area where it's like dinei nefashos. It's like making a decision to kill somebody, where just like we don't rely even upon the strongest circumstantial evidence, we don't rely upon anything less than two actual witnesses. That's just a gzeiras hakasuv. And he also quotes a medrash in Parshas Naso that says that if a woman has an affair with another man, HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees to it that a child that is born from that woman will look exactly like the features of the man with whom she had the affair. But not because the child comes from that man. No, the child is presumed to come from her real husband. But this is just to publicize the fact of her affair. So says Rav Asher Weiss, the same way that a Kodesh Baruch Hu can manufacture that the child will look like the man she had the affair with, even though the child doesn't actually come from that man, a Kodesh Baruch Hu can manufacture in order to publicize the woman's sin that her child will have the same DNA as the man that she sinned with, even though it doesn't actually come from that man. That's a very creative argument, but Rav Asher Weiss throws that into the mix as well. However, you have to ask the question, if we're going to say that for Mamzerus purposes, we're going to be lenient in part because DNA evidence is not visible to the eye, why is that considered to, why should that be considered to be good enough in terms of establishing something as a simen mufak, as an ironclad form of identification? Shouldn't an ironclad form of identification be visible to the eye? Furthermore, there is a statement made by the Rama in Simen Yud Zayin of Eben Ezer, which talks about making identifications of a person as dead, of a man as dead, so a woman can remarry, or otherwise making determinations so a woman can remarry in aguna situations. And the Rama says that in order for something to be a simen mufak, an ironclad identification mark, it has to be something which stands alone as an ironclad identification mark. But if I have a conglomeration of various low-level identification marks, and I just put it together in one big mixture, then that's not considered to be good enough. Now, it's true that some say that's only if the various lower-level identification marks are the lowest possible level, simanim gruim. If they're intermediate level, maybe you could put them together. That's a machlokas between the Beis Shmua and the Chelkas Mechokek. But those are two objections that were raised. A third objection was, how do we know? Have we checked every single person in the world in terms of their DNA? Has your DNA been checked in order to say for sure that nobody else shares the same DNA? That it can't be? That? How do we know that it's really 1 in 1 billion or 1 in 1 trillion? How do we make those types of determinations? These were all questions that were posed when I was sitting together with certain other rabbis. I remember from the Lakewood Beis Din, we met in the aftermath of the World Trade Center tragedy. We met at a shul, which was the closest shul to the New York City Medical Examiner's Office, so we can meet with any medical, with a specialist and experts in the Medical Examiner's Office about DNA science so we can understand it for halakhic purposes. So one of the rabbis said, if you're going to say that it's less than 1 in 1, you know, quadrillion of a chance that two people share the same DNA, that would imply that you've had over a quadrillion people in the history of the world, but the world is only like 5,770 years old or so. So how is it possible that you've had so many people? So we had some very interesting questions that were posed at the time. But the way in which we're able to overcome some of these questions was by consulting with many of the Gedolia poskim. One of the poskim that we consulted with was Rezalman Nechemia Goldberg Zatzal. Rezalman Nechemia said like this. He said that there's a category called Simen Mufak, an ironclad identification mark. But then there's a category that the Gemara discusses that the Gemara indicates could be even better than a regular case of ironclad identification mark, and that's Tfiyus Ayin. What does Tfiyus Ayin mean? So the Gemara gives an example. You have a lineup of people who may have committed a murder, and a person who saw the murder committed, and they look at the lineup, and they're able to identify one of the people, not by looking at them, but they remember that they measured, you know, one of the fingers of the person and it was this big. And they measured one of the toes, it was this big. And they remember there was like a yellow mark behind the ear. And they remember that the person had like a little bit of a crooked tooth. But they look at the person, they don't recognize them, but they have lots of good simanim, a lot of really, really good identification marks. The Gemara said, you can't convict a murderer that way, but if the person who's the witness looks at the lineup and says, I know this person committed the murder because I'm looking straight at him, or her as the case may be, and I know that this is the murderer, So then we say that for sure is good enough. Why is it good enough? It's not an identification mark in terms of measuring an exact amount of a space that the person's nose takes up, or the inches between the nose and the mouth, or anything else which is measurable and verifiable. It's just facial recognition. So the Gemara says, Tvias Ayin is considered to be ironclad. It's even considered to be something which we would rely upon to convict a person of murder. That's how strong Tvias Ayin is. So says Rav Zalman Nechemyah, what's special about Tvias Ayin? Tvias Ayin, you know it when you see it. It's a person's uniqueness. Normally we look at a person who says, nobody else who looks exactly like this person, they're unique in terms of exactly the way they look. Maybe you look at photographs, we have an issue of doppelgangers sometimes, but generally speaking, we say you look at somebody, you can identify the individual just straight by looking at that individual. You know it's this person. You know it's this person for sure. So he said that this uniqueness of identification, since it's not dependent upon physical measurements, it's not dependent upon visibility to the naked eye either. If a person has a uniqueness due to their genetic coding, in their DNA makeup, in the way that the base pairings of the nucleotides are arranged, you know, within the nucleus of every single cell, so that also is considered to be Tvias Ayin, that we're able to recognize scientifically the uniqueness of this individual. Rabbi J. David Bleich has a series of essays on DNA identification in some of the recent issues of Tradition, and he also makes this argument. With respect to the question of, well, is it a simon? Is it one type of ironclad identification mark? Or is it simply that I have this pair of nucleotides and this pair of nucleotides, since I have this base pairing, this base pairing, this base pairing, and when I put them all together, that's how I get my DNA code. So maybe it's just a conglomeration of lower level identification marks. So to that, there's a very good essay written by Rabbi Eliyahu Levine, who is the head of the Choshen Mishpah Kollel of Lakewood, that dealt with these issues, in which he said the identification mark is not this base pairing plus this base pairing plus this base pairing plus that base pairing. The identification mark is the Seder. Like we talk about the Haggadah Seder night. That's the Seder is the thing. The identification mark is the order itself. Just like with respect to dental records, it's the totality of the person's dental records here as well. It's the totality of the Seder, the order, that is the identification mark. It's not a conglomeration of lower level identification marks. It is one ironclad identification mark that you would be able to rely upon. And as far as the question of, do we need to examine every single person? So the answer is that we have lots of halakhic principles where we just know based on our experience that there is a certain reality that we rely upon, such as ro behemos kasheros. Most animals are kosher, meaning that most of the kosher animals don't have simanei trefos, don't have physiological signs of illness that would make them disqualified from being able to eat. So that's why we can drink the milk from a particular cow. We assume that the cow is kosher. Have we examined every single animal in the world? We haven't examined every single animal in the world, but nonetheless, it's what we call a ruba delesa. Come on. It's what we call, it's an absolutely solid majority supposition based on everything that we have seen, and that's considered to be good enough. And also, others throw in, if you look at the Gemara and Yevamos and Daf Kuf Tes Vavam and Beis, the indication is that if I don't know for a fact that there's somebody else with the same DNA, with somebody else with the same properties, I'm not obligated to assume that this is the case. Now, even those who were not necessarily comfortable relying upon DNA when it came to paternity tests and things of that variety, maybe, you know, they really could have been comfortable with DNA because it doesn't necessarily come from the blood, but it seems like you certainly have poskim who assume that there's some blood connection in DNA identification. But what about if you're dealing with mitochondrial DNA? Mitochondrial DNA is something that comes completely from the mother. Unlike your regular DNA, which is, you know, found in the nucleus of the cell, this is found in the mitochondria, which is a structure within the cell that takes food and turns it into energy. That's the best that I can describe it. So the mitochondrial DNA comes completely from the mother. Where is mitochondrial DNA going to be relevant in halacha? It's relevant in terms of identifying a person as Jewish, because there have been studies that have been made over the course of the last number of years. There's a Rav here in Israel who's been very involved with these studies by the name of Rabbi Zev Litke. He wrote a book on the subject, which shows that apparently around 40% of Ashkenazic Jewry are all descended from Abba Imos. And not Sir Rivka Rachel Leia, but four Imos from about 1,000 years ago who lived somewhere, various places in Europe. And for all the DNA that 40% of people in the Ashkenazi community have seems to come from one of these four different combinations. They trace it back to these four women. And since so many Jews share this DNA, it must be, if you have this DNA, you're probably Jewish, because they did a test. I think out of 22,000 people or so, they only found three non-Jews who had this type of DNA. And it's possible that, you know, maybe you can argue that they came from individuals who were Jewish but just forgot their Jewishness. They apostatized over the years, or they just assimilated to such a degree that they forgot that they were Jewish. But otherwise, it seemed very consistent that you have an enormous amount of the presumed Jewish population of the world who share DNA in four different types of combinations that they assume originally came from one of these four mothers. So Rav Yitzchak Yosef, in his Hagdama, his approbation to the book that deals with the question of relying upon this type of DNA for determinations of Jewish status. Sometimes you have a person who comes to the Beis Din, they want to get married, but they can't prove their Jewishness because their family hasn't been observant for many years. You don't have anyone in the observant Jewish community who can say that their mother, the grandmother, great-grandmother were definitely Jewish, that nobody converted. Maybe they had an improper conversion or something like that. So if you have this type of a test, can you rely upon it? So if Yitzchak Yosef writes in his Hagdama to this book, he says, even my father, who wasn't comfortable relying upon the blood tests, and maybe for some reason the type of a DNA determination, would be comfortable with this, because even if it would be blood-based, it comes from the mother. And the Gemara said that, you know, anything that's blood-based that comes from is presumed to have come from the mother, and therefore that's perfectly legitimate. He said he still would not rely upon it by itself, but you could rely upon it, but siruf shavakakos, with other types of hokakos, with other types of proofs that would be brought into the equation in order to come to the determination that a person is a Jewish. And Rabbi Lau, we know the Ashkenazic chief rabbi, has a nice argument where he says that people have a counter-argument. The counter-argument is maybe these four women, even if there were four women, maybe they came from families of converts. And therefore, a person could have the DNA, but it didn't come from them. It came from some other person in their family who didn't convert. So he said, well, number one, it's a suffix whether they were converts, and not too many people were converting in those days. And number two, even if they were converts, it's a suffix whether the DNA came from other members of the family who did not actually convert, or whether it came from them. So therefore, it's a sveika at best to cast aspersions upon this. And he says, called the parish, meruba parish, you can assume your average person who has this DNA, since it's shared by so many people who are known and presumed to be Jews, that your average person who has it is Jewish as well. And therefore, he felt that it's something that could be relied upon together with other indications of Jewishness, even if the other indications are not perfect. He does admit, who knows whether they'll find somewhere else in the world some tribe of people or some, you know, class of people who are not known to be Jewish who share the same DNA or one of these four different strands of DNA. So we can't be 100% certain, but it could be relied upon together with other things. There was an article I saw in an Israeli newspaper maybe a year ago or so with some sort of a scandal that the Rabbanut is forcing Russian immigrants to undergo blood tests, something like that, because of the fact that they're relying upon this together with other means of evidence. If you have somebody who comes from the former Soviet Union who doesn't have ironclad evidence, but they have some evidence, so apparently the Rabbanut is now saying that you have an option. They're not forcing anybody to take blood. That's what the article made it sound like a little bit, because, you know, it's a little bit of agenda-driven. But they're saying that you can undergo this test, and then this is something that could be taken into consideration as well. Now, this is much newer than regular DNA science, this Abba Imos theory. I'm still a little skeptical about it. I'd like to give it, you know, a little bit more time before we start relying upon it entirely. But what we have done in our own Beis Din is we have relied upon internal DNA examinations. If we know the DNA of a particular family and we just have to establish that somebody comes from that family, comes from a woman in that family, for example, in order to help to verify their Jewishness, so we will do DNA tests within a family unit. When does this come up? If we know that somebody was adopted, somebody or their mother was adopted, and we think we know that the birth mother was Jewish, but we can't, but we think we even know the identity of the birth mother. So then if we do DNA testing of people of the birth, of the presumed birth mother or members of her family, together with the person who is presumed to come from that individual, and it checks out, which is something that DNA testing can do nowadays to show that a person is very closely related to another family member. So then we will rely upon that together with other evidence in order to get over the hump, so to speak, to prove somebody's Jewishness. They ask me, I'm a Kohen, whether there's anything to this whole Kohen gene type of a test that you can do to show that a person is a Kohen. The problem with the Kohen gene is that it just shows that a person may have been descended from a particular man or men who are Kohanim, but doesn't show that they married women who are permissible to be married to Kohanim. So you can have the Kohen gene and be a non-Jew entirely. Or you could have the Kohen gene and be a Cholol. And there are plenty of Kohanim who don't have the Kohen gene, but still have, you know, good yichus in terms of they're having a very strong tradition in their family of being Kohanim. I once asked Rabbi Moshe David Tendler, you should have Rafua Shleima, who's the Rav of our community where I come from in Muncie. I once asked Rav Tendler whether, as a Kohen, I was obligated to have a test to see if I have the Kohen gene. And he said, you don't need to, don't worry, you're Kohanim. So I was happy about that. But I said, do you think that there's anything to it in terms of the Kohen gene test? So he said, exactly in this situation, if you have a situation where a man is missing and you find the body and you know that the man was a Kohen and you're able to determine that this body has the Kohen gene and the man was known to have been a Kohen, and you have other types of circumstantial evidence, so maybe that also could be taken into consideration. So I thought that was very, very interesting. So I'll just conclude by stating that certainly what we saw in the recent COVID outbreak, you know, that we have experienced this past year, we saw the importance of melding and wedding together science to halacha. That a part of Yiras Shemayim, as we mentioned at the beginning of this year, is the recognition that all of science is part of Hashem's universe. But with anything, there are halakhic parameters with respect to the application and with respect to the implementation of scientific principles when it comes to halakha. Sometimes the tests are not considered meaningful from the standpoint of halakha. Sometimes it's best to stay away from them. And sometimes you have gzeiras hakasuv, a scriptural decree that says you need actual witnesses. And sometimes, however, it gets a mitzvah to employ the scientific methods in order to engage in identification so you can free a woman to remarry. My father, Zichrono Levracha, was a town councilman, but he was also an educator. That was really his main profession, was being an educator. He introduced the Holocaust education, a curriculum in the Rockland Community College in Ramapo in New York. And he would have, and I think he did, appreciate all of these nuances, such as in the aftermath of 9/11, when I was involved in adjudicating these issues. He was always very, very interested. And he always would use his Torah observance within the community as a source of Kiddush Hashem, always wearing a yarmulke wherever he went, even to non-Jewish affairs. He had to deal with a lot of non-Jewish politicians, never spoke a Lashon Hara, was a source of Kiddush Hashem. And we should also be inspired to the same type of healthy engagement with science and the world, to be a Kiddush Hashem in terms of how we conduct ourselves. May the memory of my father be a blessing. Maybe he be a Melitz Yosher for all of us. And during this period of the 3 weeks, we should all experience the fulfillment of the Nevuah of Yirmiyahu. Ve'afakti avlam l'sason v'nichamtim v'simachtim migonam. Thank you very much.